you, Mr. Zimmerman. Seems that we have not been able to improve the sound for the webcast. So just want to let you know that the Louisville webcast begins at 3 o'clock, and that may be a better option for you to pick up a church service there. Well, I'd like to take a quick poll and ask if you have ever heard the saying that starts with these words, two wrongs. Does it sound familiar? Two wrongs don't make a right, right? That's typically the way that it ends, and that certainly is a truism. The point of the phrase, obviously, is that if someone wrongs you, it is not made better by you returning a wrong to them. Two wrongs don't make a right. It is a truism. It's similar to the statement that we read in Romans 12, verse 17, repay no one evil for evil. Or 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 15, see that no one renders evil for evil to anyone, but always pursue what is good, both for yourselves and for all. So two wrongs don't make a right. It's even biblical. It's not the way the Bible states it, but it is a biblical principle. Now, this is a very challenging statement to live up to, but I'd like to give you another variation that reflects probably the course of human nature, the way things usually work out there in the world. Two wrongs, dot, 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 usually lead to three or four or more. That's the way it usually works out there in the world. Today we're going to take a look at a story in the book of Judges to glean what we can from this story. And we'll learn, once again, that typical of human nature, two wrongs usually lead to three or four or more along the way. We're going to look at the story of Micah. Now, this is not the story of the prophet Micah from the Minor Prophets. His name was Micah of Moresheth. He lived quite a bit later than the story that we'll read. We'll go back. Micah was probably 700 B.C. We're going back quite a bit before that into the early history of Israel in the book of Judges. Quite a bit further back, completely different time. So this Micah that we'll read about today is not the prophet, or the minor prophet, as we might refer to him in the Minor Prophets. Turn with me, if you would, to Judges chapter 17. The story of Micah begins here in Judges and continues on into chapter 18. So we'll take some time to see what we might be able to learn. As we often tell our Foundation Institute students, that God had the Bible written at specific times, and it often addressed specific issues or specific doctrinal problems or specific problems in the church or problems within Israel. But God had it written in such a way that these ancient stories or these ancient problems or issues also have concrete application today as well. So while they might have been writing about a certain thing, the principles apply to us today. And those who would consider the Bible old and out of date miss that very, very important lesson. So let's take a look at Judges 17 and the story of Micah. What lessons? Well, the first lesson that I've jotted down, you can jot down others as you go along as well that you might come to your mind. But this one struck me. We do what is right because it is right. We're not forced into doing what's right. We're not coerced into doing what's right. We don't do what's right because we're afraid of the consequences if we don't do what's right. We do what's right, because it's pleasing to God. Let's take a look at how that plays out in the life of Micah. As we read the story, we'll kind of bump our heads a little bit and say, are you serious? Did he really think that way? Well, there was a man, Judges 17, verse 1, from the mountains of Ephraim, whose name was Micah. We're not told specifically, but we assume, based on where he lived, that he was an Ephraimite from the tribe of Ephraim. So they lived in the mountainous area as you depart and head north from what we would say would be Jerusalem today. So his name was Micah. And it's an interesting thing that he says to his mother in verse 2, the 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you. Pause for a second. The story opens up. Here's this man, Micah, from the mountains of Ephraim. And his mother was ripped off. His mother was stolen from. She was a victim of a robbery. 1,100 shekels of silver. That's a pretty fair sum. So we assume from that that Micah lived in a pretty nice home. He lived with a mother who had a good bit of money. If she had 1,100 shekels of silver just sitting there and somebody stole it, she was doing pretty well for herself. We're not told any other background than that. But here's this robbery that has taken place. So Micah talks to mom and says, Mom, you know that 1,100 shekels that was stolen? And he says, on which you put a curse? Even saying it in my ears, pause there for a second. She has this silver stolen from her, and while her son is standing there, she proclaims a curse on the person who stole it, that silver would burn through their hands, that some calamity would happen to them. We don't know what the cursing was that she put upon this individual, not that she had any power to carry it out. But it apparently made Micah very afraid. He heard these angry curses from his own mother on the person who would steal from this woman. Now again, we can maybe assume, it's only an assumption, maybe she was a widow. Maybe she didn't have active income anymore. This was something she was holding on to. We're not told, but the point is she pronounces this curse and it terrifies him. When Micah hears what she says, he's afraid of those consequences. So he does now, after being a thief, now he does what is right. He says, you put a curse on it even in my ears. The rest of verse 2, here is the silver with me. I took it. You almost get the sense of this little kid in the cookie jar. That, where are the cookies? You know, crumbs all around the lips. I don't know, Mom. Well, in this case, he stole it. He was stealing from his own mother. And you think, what a low life this man must have been to steal from your own mother. I took it. But you see, these words of the curse is what caused him now to do what was right. He was afraid. Christians, on the other hand, do what is right, not out of fear of God's punishment, but to strive to please God. We love God. We love his way of life. So we strive to do what is right because of that motivation. Now, obviously, in the back of our mind, we all know that there is punishment for the wicked. But we don't walk around biting our nails every day, worrying about God slamming us or cursing us in some way. We worship a very merciful God. We want to please him. So we strive as Christians to do what is right because it is right, because that's what God says to do. So he did what was right, finally returned the silver to his mother because of the guilt or maybe the fear of what she had cursed. So his mother said, in the middle of verse 2 there, may you be blessed by the Eternal, my son. Now, I don't know about you, but on one hand, you have a mother who's just cursing the person who stole this stuff and then finds out it's her own son. Oh! Maybe I'm reading more into this than God had intended. But now, so, oh, may you be blessed. You've done what was right. Maybe that's what she was thinking. Verse 3, so when he had returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother now apparently tells him what it was for. His mother said, I had wholly dedicated the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son. I was going to give it to you anyway. And you stole it? I was going to give it to you. Well, for what purpose? we'll find out it's not a very good purpose. I had wholly dedicated the silver from my hand to the Eternal for my son, to make a carved image and a molded image. Now, therefore, I will return it to you. Oh, that's interesting. So, she had set this money aside to make her son a couple of household idols. Now, again, it helps us to take just a moment and think about this process. What would motivate this woman to want to have set aside money to make these idols for her son? Well, obviously, she thought God would be pleased with this. And it shows the approach and the attitude, especially at this time of year, that the world tends to have. That we're going to do these things to please God, to show honor to God. We're going to set up a time of gift giving and parties and a holiday. And we're going to honor God and Jesus' birth by doing these things. It's the motivation this woman has. We're going to please God by making these idols. We'll pause for a second. What does God say? God is very clear in his commandments. Do not, period, make any graven image to bow down to worship. You don't do that. And yet here's her motivation. I'm doing it to please God. So you have the same attitude that continues down to this day. Look, I'm just doing these things to please God. What's wrong if I invent another day to worship God on? I'm worshiping God, aren't I? Well, then the question has to be, well, what does God say about all this? We tease at some point, you take a day like Christmas or even New Year's Day, for example, and you have all these paganisms that are tied together with them. And people say, well, look, what's wrong with that? We know Jesus wasn't born then, but still, we're doing this to honor God. What could possibly be wrong with that? And one of the illustrations I try to give is, we understand Jesus wasn't born this time. Let's do a down-to-earth analogy. You know, my wife was born in August. And so, what would it be like? How would she feel if I went to her and said, well, sweetheart, I know your birthday's in August, but I'd like to celebrate your birthday in May. Because that's when my old girlfriend's birthday was. And it was much better at that time of year because springtime, everything's blooming. August is hot and muggy. Let's just go ahead and do that in May. Now, what do you think? Don't look at her because she'll tell you what she's thinking. What would she think? Well, that's not my birthday. What? Your old girlfriend? So you understand the point. Here she is. She's going to make these idols somehow in honor of God and to be a blessing to her son, not realizing apparently or ignoring the fact that God says, don't do this. So how could she possibly think that they would be blessed? Well, as you know, this period of judges has a hallmark. And the hallmark of the period of judges was what? There was no king in Israel, so every man did that which was right in his own eyes. It's stated here in chapter 17, again in chapter 18, again in chapter 19, again in chapter 25. It's there over and over and over again. We don't do what is right in our own eyes. It leads to disrespecting God usually, and certainly other curses as well. So fear obviously should not be the main motivation for why we do what is right. Turn with me, if you would, to Ephesians chapter 6. Put your marker there in Judges 17. We'll go back in just a moment. Ephesians chapter 6. Notice in verse 5. Again, the motivation for doing what is right should not be fear of punishment. It should be a desire to please our Father in heaven, our elder brother, Jesus Christ. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 5, bond servants, in other words, employees, or in this case, they were slaves, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling, in sincerity of heart as to Christ. We do what's right because it's God's way. It's the Christian way. Verse 6, not with eye service as men pleasers, again, it's not out of fear. It's not to please others, to get from them. It's to do what is right before God. Not with eye service as men pleasers, but as bond servants or slaves of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, with good will, doing service as to the Lord and not to men. Now, we could go on from there, but you understand the point. Christians strive to do what is right because it is right. We're not trembling at fear of punishment. We're not trying to get or take advantage of others, manipulate others. We strictly want to do what God says is right. Let's go back then to Judges 17. We continue the story of Micah. Second lesson I think we can learn from this is that good intentions cannot make wrong into right. Good intentions cannot make wrong into right. We're all probably familiar with the phrase or the saying that the road to you know where, the road to hell, is paved with good intentions. I meant to, or this is what I wanted. None of those things matter. Let's go on from there. We read in verse 3, he returns it, and now mom's going to give some back to him. Verse 4, he returned the silver to his mother. Then his mother took 200 shekels of the silver and gave them to the silversmith, and he made it into a carved image and a molded image. And they were in the house of Micah. So he sets up this little shrine. Now, what was his intention for doing that? You know, I would venture to bet that his intention was good. He was trying to be spiritual in some way. He wasn't setting up an image of Satan to do evil things. You know, can you imagine in his mind, he's saying, well, I just want a reminder of God every day so that that when I go by, I think of God. That's what these idols are going to tell me to do, right? He's trying to think of ways that this is going to be a good thing. When we worked in the Houston area, a number of our church members were former Catholics, Latin in their background. And in many of their homes, when we go to visit, was this empty little spot in the wall. It had a little shelf, and usually it wasn't square, but it kind of went up and then had a little kind of curly cue up to the top and then back down the other side. It was always empty. Or maybe there was a knick-knack there or something like that. And they explained to us that that used to be Mary's spot. They had their own household gods that they set up in there. It might have been Mary. It might have been a picture of Jesus. Several of the homes used to have that, and a picture of long-haired Jesus above that. But it was their own little shrine, and the idea was, you know, we're sincere about this. It's a good intention. We want to think about godly things, and so we have this little shrine. And people say, well, what's wrong with that? You want people to think about these things, don't you? Well, good intentions cannot make wrong into right. Think of it from God's perspective. Okay, you're going to have this little silver statue. And, oh, yeah, it's good intentions. I'll think more about God if I have this little statue in my home. Think about it from God's perspective. The great God of the universe, who has created the entirety of the universe, you're going to represent me as a silly little statue made of idol. How insulting can that be? How dare you try to put me, the great God, into that thing? That created thing, the uncreated God, you're going to make a statue out of? That's a good intention, but you know where it leads. There's a way that seems right unto man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. So good intentions cannot make wrong idols into something right. Oh, it reminds me more of God. No, it doesn't. Verse 5 says this, the man Micah had a shrine. So this area, maybe a whole room in his home. Maybe it was just this little carved out area like other homes might have. But nonetheless, he made an ephod and household idols. Remember, the ephod of the high priest was used to determine God's will. there were stones on it, and you know, they would ask God to light it up, in essence, to give answers to various things, which tribe might be assigned to various responsibilities, things like that. So now he's inquiring of God on his own. Where did God say that should be done? Well, that was the priest's role. So again, doing what is right in his own eyes, completely outside of what God had said. So he had a shrine made an ephod and household idols. And he consecrated one of his sons, who became his priest. So on top of all that, look, we got a shrine, we got gods, we got an ephod. We got to have a priest now. Junior, come here. He calls Junior over, and he somehow ordains him a priest. Well, what did God say? I said, I've chosen the tribe of Levi to be my servants. In the tabernacle first, then in the temple. And out of that tribe of Levi, one family in that tribe, the family of Aaron, God designated as the priests. So God decided who would be the priest. It's not something that we have a choice in. But again, I'm just trying to be more spiritual. Can't you see? God certainly would be pleased with that. Well, no, he wouldn't. In fact, it upsets him quite a bit. You're going to decide? I don't think. It's just an extension of what Adam's sin was. Thanks, God, but I'll decide for myself. You know, you've got some good ideas, but mine really are better. We'll decide which of your laws we like, which ones we don't like, which ones observe, which ones we won't observe. We'll take care of it ourselves. It's the way of humanity. It's the way of man. So while these intentions sometimes may appear spiritual, they may appear to be good, they are a human way of trying to simply follow our own desires. God expects us to conform to his definition of righteousness rather than God being forced to conform to our definitions of righteousness. When Pam and I take a walk in front, we have a neighbor just probably three blocks away who has undoubtedly one of the largest Christmas displays in the entire Cincinnati area. He made the news on WLK, PKR, whatever his name is, I forget. But he made the news, and they did a video of his whole yard. And I don't think I'm exaggerating. What do you think? There must have been 200 different snowmen, Santa Clauses, baby Jesuses, sheep, shepherds, wise men, trains, planes, stuff hanging from the roof, stuff hanging from the kids' playground area. He also had a mailbox out there with a slit in it where you could drop money and a big thank you on the side. But what was striking to me as we walked by this each morning, I don't think I ever saw it late at night when it was lit, but we walked by and there's this giant padlock on the mailbox. So some people might be slipping donations in, but this giant padlock on there to keep people from stealing the donations. We thought, wow, that's the Christmas spirit right there. Wonderful. So was he doing this to please God, I suppose? But again, leading even small children into serious error when it comes to right worship of God. So trying to get God to conform to our standards is not the right way. That's completely backward. This is simple idolatry that Micah was involved with. He was doing it his way, and God would have to be pleased with that. Again, leave your card here or your Bible marker and turn to Genesis chapter 31. Genesis chapter 31. Is there anything new under the sun, as the saying goes? Genesis 31, verse 17. Maybe this came to your mind as you were hearing these things. Genesis 31, verse 17. Jacob rose and set his sons and his wives on camels. Remember the story? Jacob had served Laban for over 14 years for the wives that he now had, and they're ready to pack up and leave. So that's what they do. They pack up. He sets his wives on the camels, and they're about to take off. Well, what did they take along with them? What did Laban have in the house? Same thing, these teraphim, these household idols. And what did one of the girls do? She stole them, which is pretty sad, down in verse 31. With whoever you find your gods, Laban runs after them, catches up with them, and says, hey, you stole something from me. Jacob says, no, we didn't, because Jacob wasn't aware of that. With whomever you find your gods, do not let him live. In the presence of our brethren, identify what I have of yours and take it with you. For Jacob did not know that Rachel, his favorite wife, had stolen them. Now, why did she steal them? I don't know that the Bible ever answers that question. We can only speculate. Did she think that they would be a good luck charm? Did she dislike the fact that her father was worshiping with these things and wanted to get rid of them? I hope that'd be the case, but I kind of doubt it. Nonetheless, she stole them. Laban went into Jacob's tent, and you remember the story. She's sitting on the saddlebags, and he says, Dad, I can't get up. It's not a good time of month for me, so please don't make me stand up. And basically, she hid them there. So household idols were nothing new, but they were always wrong. It was a good intention, maybe, but good intentions do not make something right. In this case, absolutely wrong. So he makes his son the priest. He invents these idols and puts them into place. Let's go back to Judges 17. He makes his son the priest, again, in opposition to what God had said, whom God said should be the priests. Let's go down to verse 6, maybe for a third lesson. And that is, centralization can and should bring unity. Remember we said in verse 6, the keystone, we might say, the key principle, it seemed, of the period of the judges. In those days, verse 6, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So this is the author's explanation of why Micah is doing this and all the things that will follow as well. They're just doing what's right in their eyes. And I'm sure that for all of us, often in our prayers, we ask God, do not let me do that. Do not let me follow my own desires. Put in me your desires, your way of doing things. We don't want God to approve our plans. We want God to guide our plans, to help us put those plans together. If we just want God's rubber stamp on my plan, that's not the way to go about it. We want God to lead and guide us in that direction. So centralization was necessary. There needed to be some unity brought. And oftentimes, this is an outstanding lesson as far as the church as a whole is concerned. Talking with one person recently, and basically who said, you know, organized religion, that's what the problem is. You get organized religion, you have all kinds of problems. Wait a second, what do you mean by that? No, human nature is the problem, not organized religion. You see, in this case, everyone's doing what's right in their own eyes because there was no centralization yet. Hadn't come together. There was no king. There was no unity in this case. So why do we have organization in the church today? It's for unity. It's for beautiful programs. It's fascinating to me how often we have some who are kind of living room kind of folks say, hey, can I send my kids to your camp? Well, it's an organized religion camp. I don't know. Anybody want that? Of course they want it because they realize there's tremendous benefit in that. And it's so sad when they think, well, I don't want to be a part of any group. Well, how do you contribute? How do you help? How do you serve? Are you just a consumer? Just out there to, I'm just a consumer. I'm just shopping around. I'll get the best deal at Sam's for this and Costco for this and Cabo for that and United for this and Living for that. And, you know, it goes on and on and on. Where does it end? Where do you stop? Where do you set your feet down and serve and be a part of something and help and give and contribute? Or are we just consuming? Oh, I like the sermons over here, so I'll go there. I like the sermons. I like the Bible studies over here. You don't like, sorry, shouldn't have gotten off on that. But sometimes it just irritates me. Like, set your feet down, put your roots down, serve and give and help. Sort through these things. Use some discernment, some judgment. Nonetheless, here we have centralization needing to bring about unity. When there is no king in Israel, when there's no organization, everybody basically does what's right in their own eyes, and they don't unified together, and the whole is much poorer as a result. Turn with me to Titus chapter 1 in verse 5. There's an interesting scripture here that I think in the New Testament reflects this same principle. Titus 1 in verse 5. Paul is writing to Titus, and he's giving him a commission or a command, a job, we might say. And if we reflect on this time of Judges, we have groups of believers coming together, springing up, we might say. They hear the gospel, they hear the truth, they dedicate themselves to Jesus Christ, to God's way of life, and they need help. They need organization. They need structure, which is what God's church provides. So Paul wrote to Titus in Titus 1 verse 5, "For this reason I left you in Crete, that you should set in order the things that are lacking." In other words, organize things. Get it together. There are things lacking. And he says, "Appoint elders in every city as I commanded you." What does that require? It requires organization. It requires sorting through people's character and their ability to serve and their desire to serve. Well, what does it do? It brings unity when you have an elder in the church there to serve and to help, to guide, can give this direction as we all need. We're all, as the scripture says, sheep, and we need shepherds. We do. That doesn't make a shepherd better than any particular sheep, just different responsibilities. So in this case, Titus is asked, be sure to ordain elders. Make sure the church is organized and orderly. And that's a good and a right thing. So centralization can be a wonderful gift from God to serve God's people. And that's the design behind it. Let's go back to Judges 17 and continue on. Here's a personal lesson for me, and maybe you can apply it in your areas as well. The fourth lesson I grabbed out of this story is that the love of money can inspire compromise. The love of money can inspire compromise. Why do I say that's a personal lesson for me? Well, because elders are told to be sure that they are not stuck on money. They're lovers of money, that they're doing things for payment back. So there may be areas you can apply this as well. In verse 7, there was a young man. So enter, in this case, third character. We've got Micah, we've got mom, and we've got Micah's son, who was made the priest. Now, there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, and he was a Levite and was staying there. The man departed from the city of Bethlehem in Judah to stay wherever he could find a place. Remember, the Levites were told you don't have a physical inheritance. Like all the other tribes, they were given specific geographic areas in which to live. The Levites were not. They were asked to serve in God's tabernacle and then later on in the temple. So they would live in various places throughout the year. They would come then to serve in their rotation as that was set up later on. So this man is looking for a place to live. He came to the mountains of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, as he journeyed. Verse 9, Micah said to him, "Where do you come from?" So he said to him, "I'm a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I am on my way to find a place to stay. I'm out looking for a place to stay, to make a living." Verse 10, Micah said to him, "Aha, dwell with me, and be a father and a priest to me. And I will give you 10 shekels of silver per year, a suit of clothes, and your sustenance, room and board, as well as spending money." That sounds like a pretty good deal. Now, this Levite was out shopping, looking for a place to stay. This offer comes up, and it's a pretty good offer. Was it simply a love of money that inspired this compromise? Probably so. Because we'll find later on in the story, he makes another decision based on finances. We'll see that as we go along. So, let's zoom out and take a look at this. Micah finds out this is a Levite. And he wants a Levite now to be his priest. Doesn't say what happened to his son. If he got boot, or took the ephod off him and gave it to this gentleman now, this Levite. But it shows that there was some knowledge about what was right and what was wrong. There's some knowledge about who the tribe of Levi was, what their assignment was. Their assignment was to serve God. And now Micah thinks, well, I've got a Levite. God is certainly going to be pleased with me now because I've got a Levite to be my priest. Well, wait a second. Was he from the family of Aaron? Apparently not. It would have probably told us if he was from the family of Aaron. So he might have been qualified to help with the sacrifices or things like that, but to be a priest, that was not his role. But the pay looked good. He's not about to say, look, I'm not a priest. I'm just a Levite. I'm not of that family of Aaron. He looked at the price, the apartment, the food. Yeah, I think I can help you out here. I think I can step into this role. So he becomes Micah's personal priest. Now pause for a second. Again, look at this situation. If Micah was doing something wrong, needed to be corrected, needed to be told he was sinning, what chance do you think that this priest, Levi, would have informing Micah of that? When Micah's paying him salary, Micah's feeding him, Micah's giving him a place to live, do you think he's going to have the courage necessary to confront Micah when he was sinning? Or would he do the, filled and, be a nice guy and you're doing wonderful. And far be it from me to correct anything that you do. You're just providing. Do you see the point? It's a position many pastors in the world find themselves often, that they're being paid by the parishioners there in the audience. So I don't want to upset so-and-so. He's a big contributor. I don't want to upset her because he contributes a lot. So I've got to be careful with that. Yeah, they may be real difficult sinners, but can't do that. It's a sad situation to be in. So it's not likely that this Levite would be correcting Micah on anything. So here Micah's got his good luck charm now. He's got a real bona fide Levite to be a part of his little temple there, his little home church, we might say. So Micah gives him his offer, verse 11. The Levite was content to dwell with the man. 10 shekels a year, not a bad salary. And then free room and board on top of that, can't beat it. Of course he was content to live with him. He was content to dwell with the man. And the young man became like one of his sons to him. Not too many sons would dare correct their father, would they? So there's a warm relationship developed here. So I doubt much correction might have been a part of this relationship at all. So was it love of money that causes, in part, at least some of this compromise that is going on? That may be possible. Let's continue on. We read in verse 12, so Micah consecrated the Levite. Pause for a second. What? Micah consecrated the Levite? Who now is standing in God's shoes? Well, I'm going to decide who becomes a priest or not. Well, God, you have a nice idea, but it doesn't really fit my circumstances, so I'll decide who should be the priest. So now Micah himself is standing in God's shoes. And the Levite is simply accepting all this. So how much moral stamina did he have? Not very much, apparently. So Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. So that's where he then would be. Verse 13, then Micah said, now I know that the Lord will be good to me, since I have a Levite as a priest. Wait a second, didn't that one commandment say something about idols? Wait a second. Again, it's simply man's way of saying, God, you're going to have to conform to my standard. I'll tell you, God, how you ought to be worshipped. You better agree with me, because I'm doing it out of a good heart. I've got good intentions. Sorry, that will not be a muster. Sorry, this will not work. But it's a good luck charm. I've got a Levite now. Wow, this is really quite the little tabernacle I've got going here. My little shrine. So very sad. Another lesson then in chapter 18. Two wrongs inspire more. Two wrongs inspire more. You see, when you leave God out of the picture, wrong is inspired and encouraged because you get away with it. Notice in chapter 18, verse 1, in those days, there was no king in Israel. Right? We've heard that before. No king in Israel. And in those days, the tribe of the Danites was seeking an inheritance for itself to dwell in. For until that day, their inheritance among the tribes of Israel had not fallen to them. Remember when Joshua came into the land? The land was divvied up to various tribes, and they were expected to go in and push out the inhabitants that were there. God said the inhabitants of the land are evil, they're squatting on the land in essence, and they should be pushed out. They're not living in the area that we've assigned them to. He's given this to Israel. Well, for whatever reason, Dan either wasn't able to, as a tribe, to push out these people. Maybe they hadn't worked on it very hard yet. So they're still kind of, they've got a couple of cities that they're living in, but their inheritance, they really haven't gotten into yet. So what is fascinating is that you look in verse 2, the children of Dan sent five men of their family from their territory, men of valor from Zorah and Eshtol, from way in the south, to go way to the north, to spy out the land and search it. They said to them, go search the land. In other words, go look for a place. They're not even going to be living in the inheritance that they were given. Go find some place for us to live. So they went out to the mountains of Ephraim and to the house of Micah and lodged there. So these five end up at Micah's house. And while they were at the house of Micah, they recognized the voice of the young Levite. Now, did they recognize his personal voice? Had they had some kind of contact before? Did they recognize what he was saying, the kind of language he used? Did they recognize his accent? We're not told how they recognized him, but there was clearly some connection. Did he sound like someone from Bethlehem in Judah? Maybe so. But they turned aside and said to him, who brought you here? What are you doing in this place? What do you have here? So my guess is his accent was quite a bit different. It'd be like someone here walking in and speaking with an Australian accent, or maybe a deep Scottish brogue. What are you doing here? Where are you from? So maybe that's what was going on here. What are you doing here? Why are you in this place? And so he gives them the rundown. He said to them, thus and so Micah did for me. And then notice this. He has hired me. He has hired me. Well, what does that mean? Well, hirelings go for the money, which might be another lesson that we would draw from this. Hirelings go for the money. Why am I here? He hired me. He has hired me, and I have become his priest. So that's why I'm here. Verse 5. So they said to him, please inquire of God that we may know whether the journey on which we go will be prosperous. So now he's taking the role of priest and prophet before God. None of those things was he qualified for or called to. And the priest said to them, now pause for a second. There's no record here of the Levite actually beseeching God, going to God, using the plain ephod that he had, his breastplate with the stones on it for God's answer. There's no record of him actually doing that. Now, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. I have my supposition that he just gave them the answer they wanted to hear, because that's what he had to do all the rest of the time. The priest said to them, go in peace. The presence of the Lord will be with you on your way. When you're a hireling and you're being paid, what other answer could you give? You're not going to tell them, well, boy, you guys are all going to be destroyed. You know, what are you doing up here anyway? You don't belong up here. You're not going to say any of that. So did God actually give him this answer, or was this his own answer? The Bible doesn't tell us, but if I were a betting man, I would say this was what he made up, because he thought that's what they wanted to hear. So, verse 7, the five men departed, went to Laish, and they saw the people who were there, how they dwelt safely. In other words, they didn't have a lot of defenses. And in the manner of the Zidonians, quiet and secure. They weren't under attack, things like that. There were no rulers in the land who might put them to shame for anything. In other words, they didn't have a large standing army that a ruler had taken and put together. They were far from the Sidonians. This indication is that they were somehow connected to Sidonians, similar ethnic group, possibly families. But they were far from the Sidonians, and they had no ties with anyone. In other words, they didn't have treaties with all the surrounding cities saying, if we get attacked, then you'll all come to our aid, and if you get attacked, we'll come to your aid. They were kind of this island state, it looks like. So verse 8, the spies came back to their brethren down south at Zorah and Eshtaol, and their brethren said to them, what is your report? And they said, arise, let us go up against them, for we have seen the land, and indeed it is very good. Would you do nothing? Do not hesitate to go and enter to possess the land. So it is this kind of pep talk. We need to take this area over. Verse 10, when you go, you'll come to a secure people in a large land, for God has given it into your hands, a place where there's no lack of anything that's on the earth. So they are really hard selling this area, and it probably was a very nice area. 600 men of the family of the Danites went from there, from Zorah and Eshtaol, armed with weapons of war, and they went up and encamped in Kirjath-Jearim in Judah. Therefore, they call that place Mahanah-Dan to this day. It is there, west of Kirjath-Jearim. They passed from there to the mountains of Ephraim and came to the house of Micah. Now again, picture yourself in Micah's shoes. An army of 600 men shows up outside your gate. And the five who you put up a few weeks before walk in. Verse 14, the five men who had gone to spy out the country of Laish answered and said to their brethren, do you know that there are in these houses an ephod, household idols, a carved image, and a molded image? Now therefore, consider what you should do. Now to us that sounds like an odd way of stating it, but it doesn't take much imagination to say, hey fellas, what they got here? A lot of stuff. You know what you need to do. Clearly the implication is we're going to take this stuff by force if necessary. So they turned aside there, came to the house of the young Levite man, to the house of Micah, and greeted him. The 600 men armed with weapons of war, who were of the children of Dan, stood by the entrance of the gate. A pretty uncomfortable position to be in. All these soldiers show up. The five, verse 17, who had gone to spy out the land, went up. Entering there, they took the carved image, the ephod, the household idols, and the molded image. And the priest stood at the entrance of the gate with the 600 men who were armed with the weapons of war. When these went into Micah's house and took the carved image, the ephod, the household idols, and the molded image, the priest said to them, what are you doing? Now again, picture yourself as a hireling. There you are. Are you going to stand in front of these 600 soldiers and say, don't take that stuff? Well, if you were a man of character and honor, that's exactly what you would do. But this man was not. They said to him, be quiet. Put your hand over your mouth. In other words, shut up. Come with us. Be a father and a priest to us, to the household. Would it be better, or is it better, for you to be a priest to the household of one man or that you be a priest to a tribe and a family in Israel. So, this individual, this Levite, does a quick calculation. On one hand, likely death. On the other hand, income from 600 plus families in Dan. Priest of a whole tribe. Same idols. Sounds like a pretty good deal. So what does he do? Hirelings go for the money. So, verse 20, the priest's heart was glad. Wow, what a landfall. What a windfall of money. He took the ephod, the house full of idols, and the carved image, and took his place among the people. So the five went and grabbed the things, handed them to the priest. He sticks them in his bag and says, let's go. Hireling. Pretty sad to see that. Puts you in mind of Balaam, does it not? Who said, God says I can't curse Israel because he's going to bless them. But then the amount is increased, and Balaam says, let me think that over. Let me ask God again. And God says, no. And the offer is increased again, and Balaam says, God, I'm not sure you got this one right. And of course, I'm putting words in his mouth. So, long story short, the New Testament says that Balaam simply wanted the money. This Levite simply wanted the money. He had an offer that was pretty good, but now he's got a much better one. So, again, personal lesson for us as pastors, of course, we're told in qualifications for eldership that they cannot be lovers of money. So hopefully that's certainly true of all God's elders. Verse 21. They turned then and departed and put the little ones, the livestock, and the goods in front of them. So again, it would appear as they're traveling that they're just families migrating from one area to another. It's not a massive army ready to attack. It's just families kind of going along. All the kids were up in front and the animals. Verse 22, when they were a good way from the house of Micah, the men who were in the houses near Micah's house gathered together and overtook the children of Dan. They're going to get their stuff back. Verse 23, they called out to the children of Dan. So they turned around and said to Micah, what ails you that you have gathered such a company? So he gathered as many neighbors as he could with pitchforks and sledgehammers or whatever else they had. They were not soldiers, and they're going to take their stuff back. So he said, Micah says in verse 24, you have taken away my gods, which I made. Well, that was a true statement. And the priest, and you have gone away. Remember, it said that priest had become like one of Micah's sons. What kind of loyalty did this priest have? What a sad situation. If he'd walk away from this for a few measly dollars. You have taken the gods, which I made, and the priest. Well, he made the priest too, by the way. That's implied, I suppose. And you've gone away. Now, what more have I? How can you say to me, what ails you? And the children of Dan said to him, do not let your voice be heard among us. In other words, don't say another word, lest angry men fall upon you and you lose your life with the lives of your household. So in essence, they're saying, you want what we took? Come and get it. And we'll show you. Sad. It's the way of the world. So here they are, stealing idols. He's like, wait a second. What are those idols supposed to represent? They're supposed to represent God. What's one of God's basic commandments? Thou shalt not steal unless it's somebody else's idols or priest. Of course not. So here they are. Again, it's just so typical of the way of humans that, oh, we're doing what's right. We want God's favor to be along with us. So we'll steal idols that represent him and a priest who's not really a priest and idols that we shouldn't really have. But God's going to be pleased with us because we're doing it with good intentions. whole thing is so backward. Again, you think of this time of year, and you say the same principles apply. So this Levite was a hireling. He was simply going for the money, just like the rewards of Balaam before him. And again, we're all encouraged to have a correct view of material goods. We're not just in this life for stuff we can get out of it. So verse 26, then the children of Dan went their way. And then, and when Micah saw that they were too strong for him, he turned and went back to his house. And I guess that leads us to the final lesson that we'll cover from this story. And that is, evil has legs. Evil has legs. It has endurance. It has longevity. In other words, when you start stepping down this kind of path, it simply continues to roll and sometimes gets even worse. Let's look at the rest of the chapter and we'll close there. It says, verse 27, they took the things Micah had made and the priests who had belonged to him. Again, the priests didn't belong to God. The author rightly states this was simply Micah's priest and belonged to him, didn't belong to God. And they went to Laish, to a people quiet and secure. They struck them with the edge of the sword and burned the city with fire. In other words, they took it all over. There was no deliverer because it was too far from Sidon, and they had no ties with anyone. It was in the valley that belongs to Beth-Rehob. So they rebuilt the city and dwelt there. And they called the name of the city Dan. Those who remember the geography of the area, pretty much the northernmost part of the children of Israel was the city of Dan. And again, if you've been to this area, it's a beautiful area, beautiful rushing streams. You don't think of Middle East desert at all in this section of Israel. It's a beautiful place. But they made the city Dan, after the name of Dan, their father, who was born to Israel. However, the name of the city formerly was Laish. What happened in Dan as time goes along? Notice verse 30. The children of Dan set up for themselves the carved image. And Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land. Now we pause for a second and wonder. And Bible commentators are split on this as far as I understand. Was Jonathan the name of this Levite? Does it give his heritage there? Or was Jonathan someone else now that is put in place of this Levite? I'm not sure we can determine which necessarily it was. But the point is, the children of Dan set this up for themselves. They're comfortable with idol worship and devising their own priesthood. And as you follow the story of Dan, where do idols finally get set up? Turn over, if you would, to 1 Kings 12. You probably remember the story. 1 Kings 12 is now after the time of Solomon's death. And Jeroboam splits away and takes with him the 10 northern tribes of Israel into what becomes called the Kingdom of Israel. And Rehoboam, Solomon's son, holds on to Judah and Benjamin and a large number of the Levites in what then is called the Kingdom of Judah. Well, as you remember the story here in 1 Kings 12, the split takes place, and we have a situation where Jeroboam gets worried. He's got the 10 tribes in the north. What was one of the things that had unified them all before as 12 tribes? Well, it was worship in Jerusalem at the temple, the spectacular temple that Solomon had built. It was an issue of national pride by far. So Jeroboam begins reigning, and it starts to get close to the holy days, and he starts fretting about this. What happens when we get to the holy days, when we go to where God has placed his name and we keep the feast? You know, all these people here in the north are going to want to go back down to Jerusalem. And, you know, they'll have these nostalgic feelings of we should be together again. And they'll throw me out and kill me. So what does he do? You remember the story. He sets up false holy days. He says that Feast of Tabernacles was good, but let's call it the Feast of Tabernacles. We'll do it in the 8th month instead of the 7th month. A new Feast of Tabernacles. We're going to move to the 8th month. So he moves all the holy days so that all the people have a spot to be able to worship. They don't have to go back down to Jerusalem. And then he says, you know what? They need a little bit more than that. So if you look here in 1 Kings chapter 12 and verse 25, Jeroboam built Shechem in the mountains of Ephraim and dwelt there also. And also he went out from there and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom may return to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord of Jerusalem, then the heart of the people will turn back to their Lord Rehoboam, king of Judah. They'll kill me and go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah. Therefore, the king asked advice and made 2 calves of gold and said to the people, look, it's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up out of the land of Egypt. He set one up in Bethel, the southernmost part of the 10 tribes of Israel. But where was the other? And the other he put in Dan, the same spot where Jonathan and these household idols had been. So you start down this path. It says, verse 3, now this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one as far as Dan. And then what do they do? Verse 31, he made shrines on the high places. He made priests from every class of people who were not the sons of Levi. Same thing that Micah had been doing much earlier. See, we start down these paths of evil, and they get legs of their own. And they ride, and they endure, and they are long-term. And sometimes down the path of sin, we'll find that sin has become so strong that there's nothing less than a great deal of fasting and prayer that dislodges those sins. What dislodged idolatry from Dan? It was nothing. Until they were taken captive by the Assyrians and ripped out of their land for their sin. So when we say sin has legs, evil has longevity, don't start down this path. We as Christians strive then on a regular basis to be sure we're in a repentant attitude. We take that time once a year, certainly before the Passover, and we examine ourselves and we ask God to root out the sin that may have been taking up residence in the past year so that we're not following this pathway toward destruction. So the chapters, brethren, of Judges 17 and 18 seem on one hand like a trivial story that God includes in the scripture, but he has very important lessons for us to learn. Let's meditate on these things, appreciate, gain the benefits of what God has recorded for us here, and live these lessons from the life of